Thank you for tuning in to The Queer Truth, a podcast that takes on a variety of topics from pop culture to everyday life. I'm Chantel C. You can call me CC, and I'm joined by my partner in organizing, Denise. What it do?
Do what it do.
Oh, Denise, we're back. And so many things have happened. If they're positive, I haven't decided yet. Let's start with British Vogue. We spoke earlier this year about the fact that Edward Enninful has taken over as the new editor-in-chief. He's a Black man. He's been very successful. He was named fashion director of ID at the age of 18, the youngest person to ever be named fashion director. Now he's the new editor-in-chief at British Vogue. And this week, he gave us a sneak preview of what his first issue would look like. On the cover, Adjoa Abur, a British Ghanaian model and feminist activist, as she calls herself. She's 25 years old. And I will just point out that Edward is also British Ghanaian. So I see what you did there.
I know. They stick together. They stick together.
And everyone was excited. They even like previewed a video of for this issue with Naomi Campbell interviewing Sadiq Khan. Sadiq Khan is the mayor of London. He is a brown man, Pakistani roots, and the first Muslim mayor of a major European city.
And he and Naomi were born in the same year.
In the same year, both South Londoners. Really exciting. So why is this important? Why is everyone like, oh my gosh, the new Vogue? We should be excited. Are like Black women supposed to like run out and buy it now?
I hope not, actually, because we don't have the numbers. Like to really take it over the top for real like that. I really want this to show that we're universal, that our stories are universal, because in the past, the idea was that our stories were specific and only the white experience could be universal. So now having these, you know, the icon Naomi interview somebody, I hope she's moving into another career, by the way, as an aside. I hope this is our Oprah breakout moment. But anyway, I hope so. I want to see Naomi on everything. I'm sorry. I just need that. Yeah, I hope that it shows.
She can stay on Empire. That's just.
That we're here for everybody. We're the template of so much in the culture anyway. Why is it that we don't get to take center stage? Why is it that outside of entertainment value, our stories are not told? So I love that he's doing this. I hope it continues.
And on the other half, we had Just Vogue, not British Vogue, Just Vogue announced that Rihanna was going to co-host the 2018 Met Gala. Now, Rihanna comes to the Met stunting every year, right? Like
she owns it. It's like about her. She owns it already. So
she already owns it. Like everyone is always focused on saying, what is Rihanna going to wear? And what I thought was interesting though, she's co-hosting, right? Amal Clooney, who is also known as George Clooney's wife, and Donatella Versace are also co-hosting the 2018 Met Gala, which the theme is also questionable. It's called Heavenly Bodies, Fashion, and the Catholic Imagination. Now, I imagine, and this may be wrong of me and maybe unfeminist of me, I imagine that Amal Clooney is at least in part co-hosting it because it's a month before the release of Ocean's 8, where the cast is trying to pull off a heist at the Met. That might be wrong of me to assume, but you know, Amal doesn't have like star status. She has star status in like her expertise of legal, humane stuff. But everybody was talking about Rihanna. That's who everybody cared about.
Yo, this is just team too much. They trying to have somebody for everybody. For the old heads, they trying to have Donatella. Like, look, we establishment still. Don't forget. And for like the progressives and the people on the political front, they trying to have Amal. Because she's saving his children. You know how she do. She Amnesty International. That's who she is. And then, you know, for the culture, they trying to have Rihanna. I ain't never heard of a three-way co-host. I don't know if I would take that up. That's a lot. Like, you stand it. We that's, you know, we all got a corner. Like, what? We got a room? Like, how that work? How you do that? I don't understand. It's very confusing. I have never seen a mall in a dress that wasn't business formal, business casual, and business for the business dinner on a time. Like, that's all she do. So I dig her. She's consistent with her style. I'm not knocking on her style. She's supposed to be super, super classy and all that. That's cute. But what Met Gala has she ever, like, owned the front page of? Come on now.
That's my point. That's what I'm saying. Like, really, they just needed Rihanna. They could have just stopped there.
Yeah, like, so you think George Clooney's doing some cross promotion?
Yeah, I really do.
He's going to be the one in the Poom Poom shorts. So let's just go.
You know, even if it's not George, it's the Met, since it's supposed to take place at the Met, right? I mean, it makes sense. It makes sense to have her.
And Donatella establishment, let her host by herself. If y'all want Donatella to host, don't be just doing this co-host business. We got a co-host this year. Like, stop it. At this point, y'all just, you're doing too much.
In other news, Out Magazine came out with its list of Out 100. And who is gracing the cover? Lena Waithe. If it's not her year, I don't know whose year it is. We've talked about the fact that we loved the episode Thanksgiving, which she also wound up winning a historic Emmy for. And in her acceptance speech, she mentioned the superpowers of the LGBTQAI community and said that the world is special because we are in it and what we contribute to it. When asked about that at Out Magazine, she said, quote, "I wanted to say something about our community, particularly the queer community, to share that with them." She went on to say, "It was bigger than me, bigger than one episode of television. To me, that was a moment to really see people in the community and tell them I see them and tell them the things that make us different are actually what make us special. If I wasn't a queer Black woman, I don't know if I would have been standing on that stage. I hoped that they could see through me that when you tell your story, when you live your authentic life, only good things will come from it." End quote. Now, obviously, we can't answer that question. If she wasn't a queer Black woman, would she have been standing on that stage? I think that's a hard wish to have. How do you feel about that?
It's you can't separate the identity from the person. It's just not how that works. I think this kind of leads into this fear, yet also assumption of affirmative action decisions, per se. It's a package situation. So we live at these intersections. So yeah, she's a queer Black woman. She's also an educated queer Black woman, right? Like, she's also coming from a specific place with a certain ethic and with a certain set of experiences, right, that equipped her long before she got those opportunities to maximize that opportunity. So she has this amazing speech where she talks about how she had to make like something like 20 phone calls to like reach, I forgot who she was trying to reach, whether it was Ava or Oprah, but you know, like she straight up had to start from the cold call yellow pages level,
right,
of like, and now I'm trying to get on the phone with a major player, and did it. And I don't know if most people have it in them to do that, right? So there's something in her, that drive, that focus. There's some people, no matter what identities they get strapped with by the consequence of birth, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be at the top because there's something about them that just kind of puts them in the mind space of being able to just push through whatever the circumstances are in front of them. So yeah, I love her. I'm hoping to see her new projects, and I really want her to be featured on more stuff.
Absolutely. So she is a busy woman. Mm-hmm. And as we mentioned before, she has a new drama series that she's writing. It'll be the first time she's written this way, called The Chi, which is named after where she grew up, Chicago South Side. And it follows an interconnected group of working class Black Americans, and it premieres on Showtime in early 2018. I'm looking forward to that. She also has a part in Steven Spielberg's Ready Player One, which is based on Ernest Cline's dystopian sci-fi novel. That is coming out in March 2018. And she has penned a film that she ain't saying a whole lot about, but she just said that it's protest art.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
All right. I'm about the protest art.
But what I'm most excited about is a sitcom called Twenties, which kind of is like her telling her own story of how she moved to Los Angeles. And the lead just happens to be a Black queer girl, which I don't think we've had yet at all.
I mean, can we just take a moment to talk about all of these stories about young Black life and that are just honest, written by Black people, acted by Black people? We had the incredible Jessica Williams on Netflix, right?
Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah.
Where it was just a full on movie about her trying to be young, single, and dating people in New York. Insecure.
Was that written by a Black person though? She didn't write Jessica. That. She didn't write that.
Jessica wrote that? No.
She didn't write it.
So somebody else wrote that?
Yeah. She just added it.
We got Atlanta.
Atlanta. Right? Can we just pause for that one? Atlanta. They said they're going to be back in like 2019. I was like, that's not exciting. I need y'all back like today.
Yo, he on Star Wars now.
Donald Glover is very busy. He's very busy.
Yeah, man, we got so many, like, we got Queen Sugar, we got this plethora of stories, even Blackish, which is now morphed into Grownish, right? We have this plethora of stories that have come out in part because we have this morphing of web series into real distribution channels that are in people's homes in a very kind of mainstream way, like Amazon and Netflix and all this stuff. I mean, this is a moment that I never thought I would see.
Really?
Not like this. Not like this. There was always this kind of, you know, the single story that was told. There was only one of us allowed to be on air at a time. Mm-hmm. There was only like one network that was really checking for us, and it was usually the network on a come up, and that would drop us.
Very
as soon
true.
As
Very true. When I think about Martin.
So, I mean, it's kind of like we're having this 90s moment, because if you remember the 90s, we had Family Matters, we had Living Single, we had Martin. Right? Like, we had all these shows all at one time happening, and it was magical, but then it ended abruptly.
Yes. Yes. Really abruptly. I don't think any of us were ready for it. But we'll end on a high note, because that was all really good what you just said. We won't talk about Tyrese's tears. Or Diddy's supposed name change and then unchange. We will
sorry,
end.
I don't know a Diddy. I just know love.
In our second segment, we will talk a little bit about U.S. elections. So on the 1 year anniversary of the downfall of Western democracy, we saw democracy try to pull itself back together. We saw good turnout, decent turnout for an off-year election. And this different states and different cities were voting for different things. It was really hard to keep up. But I will mention, I mean, there were a lot of firsts, but I'm just going to mention some of them. We had Democrat Wilmot Collins, a refugee from Liberia, became the first Black mayor in the history of Montana. Montana has a Black population of less than 1%. We saw Democrat Vi Lyles become the first Black female mayor of Charlotte, North Carolina. She ran on a progressive platform aimed at promoting social and economic justice and increasing the city's minimum wage, which North Carolina has been, many cities in North Carolina have been pushing for that. We had Andrea Jenkins running for city council in Minneapolis, Minnesota. She became the first Black transgender woman in the nation to be elected to a major city council. In Virginia, we had Democrat Danica Roan become the first openly transgender person to ever be elected to a U.S. state legislature. And funny story, she defeated the Republican Bob Marshall, who was the architect of several pieces of anti-trans legislation during his time in the state house. We had Democrat Justin Fairfax become the second Black American elected to statewide office in Virginia. He is the lieutenant governor to Ralph Northam, who won the Virginia gubernatorial race. We had Ravi Bala become the first Sikh mayor in New Jersey. And then Gopal became the first Indian American state senator in New Jersey. I mean, the list is very long. I'm just going to mention one more. Democrat Jenny Durkin was elected mayor of Seattle, making her the city's first out lesbian mayor. Thought that was interesting that Seattle is so far behind. I mean, Houston already had its first lesbian mayor, but
I'm not happy about Jenny, but all right.
We're going to get there. So let's breathe. Let's breathe through it. Let's breathe through it. Everyone was really excited, right? Everyone was like, ooh, listen to the first. Listen to the first. All these firsts. This is amazing. What an election day, and so on and so forth. And then yesterday, Charlene Carruthers, who we interviewed earlier this year from BYP 100, she put out a post on Facebook and then shared it on her Twitter feed and on Instagram. And she wrote, quote, "Now that we know the identities of all the new elected officials, tell us about their politics. Identity politics, when divorced from radical and liberatory political commitments, get us more liberalism, white nationalism, and misogyny. I want to know more about these candidates beyond how queer, trans, woman, black, and brown they are. Being from a marginalized group doesn't make you automatically about the business of social justice. We all should be more curious," end quote. Straight in her comments, somebody immediately posted a link from an anarchist page. The name of the article, this ain't my words, folks. The name of the article is, quote, "Down with High Pig Jenny Durkin."
Yes, please. Yes, please.
That is the name of the article. So just because someone is lesbian, that does not make them queer. And Jenny Durkin has a pretty horrible record of the things that she did as district attorney. I don't feel like going into all of them, but let's just say she thought it made more sense to work with a 5-time sex offender to lure 2 Muslims into a terror plot, both of whom had documented mental health challenges and were not properly treated. That's just one example of the many things that Jenny Durkin has done.
So, yeah, as someone who has been in the Seattle queer scene, because I lived in Seattle for some years, it was the first time that I had to step outside of a queer politic, because class politics, you know, for a lot of people obliterated any kind of oppression that they would have faced as a queer person per se, right? Because they were like way above it. And Jenny Durkin is one of those people, and she's a millionaire. And her racial politics are horrible. Her sexual politics are horrible. I think that we need to stop assuming that just because someone shares an identity, that they are that they share the political inclinations that is necessary for the liberation of most of the people that share that identity. Jenny Durkin is a great example of someone who is on the fringes in a lot of ways, but uses her identity to her own benefit, right? Because she fakes left and goes right, you know? It's a huge, huge problem. I mean, that we kind of touched on a little bit when we dealt with these, we had an episode where we talked about gay conservatives in Rotterdam, that you could be gay and staunchly conservative. Durham is facing this because there's Durham, which is about 40% Black in North Carolina, generally had like an elite Black community that was representing them. And as the city became more progressive, a lot of those people are now, a lot of those positions are now being taken by people that are transplants to Durham, people that are younger, oftentimes people that are even queer or something like that, but definitely have more of a progressive slant. And so there's a tension between, we really want these progressive politics, right? But at the same time, we also really want an adequate representation of the population. I think that what Seattle got is the adequate representation of the population. I think that Jenny Durkin is very representative of the kind of people that Seattle has in some ways, unfortunately, which is a lot of reason why I left Seattle. But she is not at all representative of progressive politics.
Exactly. On the other hand, we have trans woman Andrea Jenkins, who I mentioned was elected to the Minneapolis City Council. She ran on priorities which include developing affordable housing, raising the minimum wage, addressing youth violence as a matter of public health, and supporting minority artists. So she personally is a historian, and she also identifies as a poet, prose author, performance artist, and she's received numerous grants for her work and so forth. So the thing about that is she has run with these priorities, but she's on the city council, right? She's not doing this all on her own. And I wonder if, because you and I have differing opinions on this, which we know from other candidates, but I wonder if we don't put too much pressure on individuals to change whole institutions and systems that they weren't a part of building. So she has these priorities, and from what I can see, those are very progressive priorities for her city. She knows her city well. And now, let's say, you know, we know her politics, what Charlene was criticizing. Okay, we know her identity, but we also know her, at least some of what her politics look like. But if she doesn't, if she's not able to successfully get those things through, does that make her less worthy of praise? It's not all on her, right? So I'm wondering, like, how do we evaluate, how do we assess someone's success in a political structure that wasn't made for them?
This is a hard one because our political process is so severely broken in the sense that because of the way that districts are set up, there isn't always a clear representational democracy, right? We have to get, Democrats have to get so many more votes in order to get the same effects because the electorate has been drawn by the Republicans in both states. So there isn't this direct, almost like transactional understanding of who represents me, how do I log what they have voted on certain things and how they then perform. It's really hard to see that. And so we have a political situation that is much more kind of motivated by team politics or like almost like sports team fervor than it is motivated by what people's records are. And we see that with Roy Moore in Alabama coming up, right? Mm-hmm. Where you have his base being saying that they have Christian conservative values, but are of course not at all swayed. But when allegations, right? Allegations of underage sexual assault then come up from him that have been corroborated and double corroborated and triple corroborated, right? Because at the end of the day, they want someone on their team on the bench.
Well, right? I mean, Trump's greatest supporters were white evangelists and he was the least Christian candidate.
Right.
So among the Republicans. However, on the other end, you had a very successful run in Virginia where Republicans did everything they could from redistricting to gerrymandering to voter suppression. And yet and still, Democrats came out on top. You have a Democrat governor replacing a governor who already made it possible for felons to vote. Right. So already last year, Republicans came for him and the Virginia Supreme Court said, no, you cannot make such broad sweeping reinstatements of people to vote. You have to go through their applications individually. And the governor said, OK, so I'll do that. And something like 163,000 people were allowed to vote who have felons, who have felonies on their records because they've, you know, they've served their time. They're out of parole and probation. They're back in the workforce and they were allowed to vote. And so some people will claim, Republicans, for example, that that's feeding the Democratic base. Maybe, but they're all of their tactics, gerrymandering, redistricting, and voter suppression still didn't keep Democrats from sweeping the state. And this, what, like just what, 2.5 months after Charlottesville? So is maybe there is something changing, but someone like Andrea Jenkins does serve on a city council. So it might be different in this case. And we had several people like the new mayor and the mayor-elect in Charlotte and the mayor-elect who's also Black in St. Paul, Minnesota. These are people who are over a city rather than a district. How can we assess their work?
Yeah, local politics, I think, are the shining light here because there is much more of a direct relationship with your constituents in a local politics. City council can't get away with a lot of a lot of stuff, right? That's not happening. There's much more transparency for the city council record than there is for the state level. Just in part, the city council meetings are televised and also open to the public.
Right.
So I think that this person will be very, very held accountable. And usually these are people you could like roll up on at the supermarket. So, I mean, like, it's a very different relationship you have with your local elected politicians than you have with your state elected politicians.
So what will we do to keep an eye out? What's going on?
To keep an eye out?
Mm-hmm. To assess from time to time if we're still excited about all these firsts. How can we do that? Fairly.
Well, I'm not.
Semi-fairly.
I'm not. Yeah. Like, I, first of all, I'm not excited about any first in 2017. Sorry.
Thank you. That's what I keep saying. We're talking about first in 2017.
Any first in 2017 is a huge pop mark on the record.
Right.
Of whatever institution it's a first of. And then when you have like a first, like, you know, Jenny in Seattle, it's a cynical first. It's like a FU first, right? Like it's an affront to the community that would celebrate the first. You know, this is a loss for queer homeless kids. This is a loss for reproductive, like it's a loss on so many levels. Yet, you know, I'm supposed to celebrate it because of who she's going home to at night. Like, nah, B, I'm not interested. I'm not interested.
In our final segment, I know it's your favorite.
I love it, love it.
What are you excited about? What are you looking forward to?
I would take a moment to say I don't get excited very often. But looking forward to, right now is there are two film festivals that are happening in Vienna. One is This Human World Film Festival. So I was just on a panel discussion that happened after Stories of Our Lives, which is about the gay experience in Kenya. It's an amazing film that has been out for a couple of years. It was created by a collective called the Nest Collective in Kenya. And so that was amazing. So This Human World is happening. And so they have, you know, a lot of queer films, a lot of African films that's happening here. And then another film festival is the Transition Queer and Minority Film Festival. I will say that I have looked through the entire lineup. Mm-mm. And there are no black.
Stop. I knew it.
You knew it?
When you said, I have looked through the entire lineup, there was nothing else that was going to come out of your mouth.
I looked through the entire lineup. I read every description, every word off Deutsch and in English. Looked at the pickers and was like, so, like, nary a black person. The Queer and Minority Film Festival. So that's disappointing. But I know that they struggled to get funding. They got it at the last minute. They pushed it through. They did the best they could, blah, 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 blah. I'm sure I'm going to hear all that. But as a person.
You're just delivering them all kinds of outs. Look at that.
Yeah, I know what we're going to hear. So I'm just giving you a preview.
Okay.
But as a person, I was just like, how are we going to call something a queer minority film festival? Mm-hmm. And like, you can't find there a black film, like just one. And we're talking about a lineup of like 20 films plus. So that was a bit disappointing. But I think that there is, it's kind of like one of the things where, you know, you see the limits of a POC identity, right? You know, if you don't have black people on the table, anti-blackness exists in of color cultures, right?
Of course.
So, so that's what's up. But as a whole, I'm glad that they exist. I hope that they grow and they expand their political consciousness. What are you looking forward to or excited about?
I was excited about the character posters for Black Panther that were released this week.
Yes.
Those character posters had me all in my feelings because I know that my main man, Michael B. Jordan, is going to do something. He's going to be the villain. And I love him.
Yes.
And I would still love him, even as the villain. Because he's, that's, you know, what's there not to love? But I was so excited. I love the character posters. I think they're great because character posters, I get excited about those because I feel like they give you a little window into the soul of the character. And I felt like they were done really well. So I'm super excited about.
I don't even know if Hollywood is ready for how much money this movie's going to make. You know, I don't think so. I don't think that they're ready. I think they're like, well, we'll just get the buzz out now. We'll hope that you guys have, you're okay with your, but it was
you
just.
You don't think they learned anything from Get Out and Girls Trip, two of the most successful films this year?
I get that. You would think, because more in line with this movie, what you want to look at is Star Wars and Finn and that role, right? Because this is sci-fi, this is adventure, this is action. So that's the direction we're going in this, not like the girls movie or the.
I'm just saying, those are two movies, you know, written, directed by Black people, starring Black people.
People think in genres, right? So you may have, you know, Black people doing well in one genre and then the other genre won't give them a chance. Mm-hmm. So this is the genre because this is the biggest money-making genre. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. More than horror, more than your, you know,
it has to be, right? Because it's also the most expensive.
It's the most expensive to make. It's more time intensive. It's character intensive. And so it's an ensemble cast. You got so many heavy hitters on this cast. I just really want, like, I personally would pay, like, for an entire classroom of Black students to see this movie. Because I just feel so strongly about it. I just love it. Like, this is revolutionary. And I don't really think that they're ready. And it's coming out in Black History Month. Mm-hmm. Ooh, in February.
I'm sure that was no coincidence.
Girl, I'm a roll up. You know, I got like several Black Panther ensembles. I got a Kente cloth ensemble. Mm-hmm. I'm so excited. And I just want to know, where can I order these full length posters to put on my wall? Where?
That's what I want. I want the poster. I want it for keepsake.
Oh, so I feel very strongly. The Lupita picture really got me.
You such a Lupita fan.
You know, I love Lupita. I love her. Love her. I love, but I also like the ensemble of all the women. Somebody put together mm-hmm. a picture of the main feature images of all the women, and it was just like amazing. It's amazing. The whole thing, just visually, I'm thrown. I'm already a fan.
Well, that's all for this week. If you would like to keep up with us, you can follow us on Twitter at The Queer Truth. We'd love to hear your thoughts on some of the things we've discussed today, so feel free to get at us. And if you have a spare dime, you can give us a donation on patreon.com/thequeertruth. Until next time, peace out.